The Fearless Podcast, in a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the Fearless Podcast. This is episode 52. And I have another awesome guest on today. And I want to introduce y'all to Pastor Tommy McMurtry. And hey, Tommy, how you doing today?
I am doing excellent. Appreciate you having me on the program. Looking forward to the conversation.
I appreciate you taking the time, and I want to kind of set this up just a little bit. So we did a podcast a while back about the red heifer, and the title was "The Red Heifer Could Be a Problem." And I got all this like backlash because of the title, and because my premise was, if it ever happens, like if they try to sacrifice this thing, it's going to literally create like real time World War III nuclear action. And the way that they've been continuing to recycle the story about the red heifer made me to speculate, you know, since I don't subscribe to this pre-tribulational rapture paradigm. So therefore, there doesn't need to be a third temple for the Antichrist to sit in the Holy of Holies. I have a real interesting story about, you know, I was raised pre-trib, and that's what I was taught, and that's what I was taught in seminary and all these different things. And I don't know if you've ever heard of Brother James Beller, American in Crimson Red.
Yes. Yep. I know him.
Yes.
I knew him.
Yes. So like 10 or 12 years ago, I get this book and I start reading it and I'm like, wait a minute, Baptists have always been persecuted through history. Like, well, how does that work with this whole tribulation thing? If like, we're not going to suffer tribulation, like why did all of our forefathers and ancestors and lineage, like why did that happen? And so I started studying this whole pre-tribulation thing. And I'm like, wait a minute. Well, that is totally false. So then I'm like, well, if that's false, then this whole third temple idea, like if we're the temple, how does that work? And then I'm like, well, wait a minute. This could just be geopolitical leverage to continue to create anarchy in the Middle East, and then also garner American Christian capital to continue to stir this pot and to get all of these Christians on board with this, with the genocide that's currently going on in the Middle East. And so I heard you on an interview with Paul Wittenberger, and then you said, you know, you were boots on the ground, you were over there in Israel, and you started to question whether or not like this third temple build was even going to happen. So maybe you could flesh that out for us a little bit. Maybe tell us why you were starting to draw that conclusion, because that was a hypothesis I had. And so that's why I wanted to have this conversation.
Yeah. So, I'm working with Brother Paul Wittenberger right now on a documentary called A City Lost, and it is about the temple, the true location of Solomon's temple. And it's going to be coming out here pretty soon. We don't have an exact release date yet, but when we originally went over there, one of the major things we were planning on talking about in the documentary was the effort to get the third temple rebuilt. And unfortunately, you know, many Christians are supportive of that. It's like they think that because the Bible prophesies the building of a third temple, that we should support this. But wait, that's a bad thing. It's a, for many doctrinal reasons, and I won't go into all of those right now. And so that was one of the things that we wanted to do, though, in the documentary. We wanted to show why it's bad for there to be a third temple and why we shouldn't support it. And we do cover in the documentary why there's no need for another temple. And we do cover this anyway. But 20 some years ago, I had gone to Israel back when I had a Zionist mentality, pro-Israel, the whole nine yards. And we went to a place called the Temple Mount Institute. And at the Temple Mount Institute, we were told they got everything that they need for a third temple. All the artifacts are there. They're just waiting to get rid of that Dome of the Rock, and then they got everything ready to go. And then it was like things kept getting added to it over the years. And we went, we looked at all the things. And I heard an evangelist one time, he said they have warehouses out there that have all these prefabricated prefab building materials for everything's ready to go. And they promoted it to us that way there. So we were really hoping to get an interview with them. And we went there, went and did the tour and everything. And first off, I'm convinced that the stuff wasn't even the same things that they had when I was there. For example, the gold stuff there looked fake. When I went 20 some years ago, it looked real. And I don't know if it's just that I was believing everything they said, but even when I went there, I thought these were like real gold things that they would actually use. But we got done. I was like, are those the same artifacts that were in there 20 some years ago? Cause they're in a new location. One person said they were, another person said they weren't.
Wow.
And I asked it, I said, so are these going to be used in the third temple if it gets rebuilt? They said no. So then I started asking, you know, and I'm asking all these questions, like about the building. I said, do you guys have warehouses somewhere where you have all the building materials? And the guy looked at me like I was crazy. He's like, what are you talking about? And so I'm asking all these questions, you know, hoping to just find out all this stuff. And he's looking at me like I have two heads. He has no idea what I'm talking about. And wow. He just said, yeah, there's a lot of rumors about us. But he said, we're just here to just bring awareness to the Jewish culture and the history. That's all we're there for. And because I said, you know, don't people donate money to help rebuild the temple? And he's like, yeah, but it's used for bringing awareness. So
propaganda. Wow.
And this is what he said. They would not do a video interview. You got to go through so much stuff to get a video interview with them. And it wasn't happening, but they'll talk to you in person. And this is what he said because I'm asking all these questions. He just said, nobody's trying to get the temple rebuilt.
So I have heard all of those urban legends. I've heard exactly what you're saying. I've heard it repeated. I couldn't even honestly tell you how many times I've heard it. I've heard all this. The temple is already prefabbed. It's all prefab. They'll be able to erect it within hours, you know, because I guess that's how you make eminency work too, is like you have to have an instant temple or whatever. But this is where I was drawing as I'm going through chronologically the timeline and trying to make stuff work. And then I'm like, well, wait a minute. You know, the first conclusion I drew is like, well, Christ was the final sacrifice. So any sacrifice after the cross would obviously be an abomination to God. It's a clear rejection of the Messiah. It's clear rejection of Christ. So you can't cut off the sacrifice and oblation. That cannot be referring to a real sacrifice in a real temple. And so from a New Testament perspective, we know that we are the temple of God. So then how do we reconcile these things? And that's when I'm like, so once you draw that conclusion, once you get your eschatology figured out, then you're like, this is all geopolitical propaganda. And then once you understand the Balfour Declaration and the Rothschilds and how the reconstitution of the UN nation state came to be, it really becomes just a beast machination. It really becomes a integral component of the beast system, like a facet of the beast system.
Oh, absolutely. And I think if the nation of Israel, in quotes, is anything, it's the beast system. That's what it is. You know, and so why are we supportive of it? Why would we encourage it in any way? And so when it comes to a third temple, I mean, I won't go as far as saying there will not be a third temple, but I will say that I don't think there has to be. In fact, if I was to bet money, you know, on what the abomination of desolation was going to be, I would be more likely to say it's when the Antichrist basically tries to insert his mark into the temple of God, which we do read about in Revelation with the mark of the beast. I don't think it will have anything to do with the third temple. But at the same time, that temple being rebuilt, that would be a huge rallying point for the world in a lot of ways. It would cause a lot of different things. I think both things can happen simultaneously, but the actual fulfillment of those prophecies will take place in the way we see it in Revelation, where you have them trying to implement the mark of the beast, or something along those lines. Because where people get confused on eschatology is we have old covenant. The way I put it, we have old covenant eschatology, we have new covenant eschatology. All eschatology will find its fulfillment through Christ. Old covenant eschatology was directed at Israel and was intended for the nation of Israel. Mm-hmm. But because of their sin, because of their breaking of the covenant, because of all their failures, those things did not come to pass through a physical nation. Those things, though, will still be fulfilled, but they will be fulfilled under the new and better covenant, which will have, it's going to look a little bit different than the way we see it. Those things will still have fulfillment. But I do believe that when we look at the book of Daniel and he's giving prophecies about these abominations and desolations on Jerusalem, that obviously we would have a very Israel-centric focus when we're looking at all of that. And when we read about the abomination of desolation, well, it sure does look like he's going into the temple and that. But again, in 70 AD, when Jerusalem gets taken over, we don't see any deliverance during that time. You know, we don't see any of the good things because, again, they failed under the old covenant. The good end of the prophecies did not come to pass because these people were too sinful. They had no faith. And so we are still looking for fulfillment of the positive aspect of those things, but it's going to be through Jesus Christ. It's going to be through a spiritual nation. And so I believe Revelation is what we would call, you know, what I call New Covenant eschatology. And so when we're reading prophecies in the New Testament, understand when Jesus is giving the prophecy in Matthew 24, what's very interesting about that, when he gets to the part about the abomination of desolation, those words, we'll see those are in red. Matthew is recording the words of Christ. But you will also see in there, not in red, whoso readeth, let him understand. And, you know, now why did he say that? I don't know for sure, but I could speculate that maybe we as a reader, we're supposed to understand that while Jesus is quoting this prophecy, referencing Daniel's prophecy, you know, we know not to look for fulfillment of these things through a temple and in Jerusalem and things like that, because the Olivet Discourse too has the possibility of a negative outcome. And it's the same thing when Paul in 2 Thessalonians 2, he's literally using language from Daniel. And he's referencing teaching that he gave them, but he does not tell us what all that was. He doesn't go into all the details of it. And so I'm not saying those prophecies are not going to be fulfilled. I believe they are going to be fulfilled, but I believe under the new and better covenant. And so it's going to look a little, it could look different.
And you're making a great point. And the more I interact with people, especially on social media, and the more I consider these different points and ideas, I'm drawing another conclusion. You know, this whole Hebrew roots movement and whole Bible followers and all this stuff, the same, very similar to Catholicism. You know what the problem with Catholicism is they have priests. Oh, well, you know, there was priests in the Old Testament. So, you know, our priests are just a New Testament version of the Old Testament, right? So they repackage this paganism and they have these priests, even though the new covenant, the New Testament tells us that we are believer priests and our high priest is Christ. We don't need a man, right? And it's the same thing with this Judeo-Christian stuff. You know, because of the Catholic Church, everybody thinks Jesus looks like Caesar Borgia, some white guy, right? And they think that Jews are white. And according to this modern day mythology, all Jews are white. So, like, you know, well, Jesus was white. All the Jews are white now somehow. And, you know, we're Judeo-Christian. So you get from this same, like, pre-trib, like dissecting, like, well, there's the Jews and then there's the Christians and we're Judeo-Christian. It creates so much confusion. We have all these people, they'll say, I'm saved by grace through faith, but Jesus said to obey his commandments. And there wasn't a New Testament when Jesus was teaching. So what was he teaching? He was teaching the Old Testament. You know, they ignore the mystery of godliness. They ignore the mystery of iniquity. They ignore all of the fulfillment of Israel and who Israel really was and all the things that Christ did to fulfill all of those things. And it really has a lot to do with this conflation of who Israel is, who the Jews are. And, you know, I try to explain to people, I'm like, there's a reason why Chronicles gives you this genealogy. There's a reason why the gospel gives you the genealogy of Christ, right? That is the seed. The fulfillment was in that seed, not seeds plural, that seed, that genealogy. And then God's like, and just in case you didn't get it, I'm renting the veil from top to bottom, and I am going to incinerate the genealogy. So whether if you want to try to do that or not, I just disintegrated all the genealogy so you can't do it. Mm-hmm. And I preserved the genealogy in my seed, Christ. He fulfilled all the fulfillments. He did it all. It was finished and it's done. And so I'm going to eradicate, like, you know, and that's what Christ said, like this. This whole thing is going to be torn down, you know, and he spoke of his body, and they didn't get either sides of the memo. They didn't understand that the judgment was coming, and they didn't understand who Christ was and what he was fulfilling. And we have that same thing today. We're going to reach the Jews in Sheepshead Bay, New York. So we're going to have like a Seder and, you know, we're going to have a Christian Seder because we have to reach these people. And I'm like, man, that lamb you're eating is Christ. Like it's almost tantamount to like the idea of the cookie God, the sacrament, you know, like body of Christ. I'm like, it's relatively speaking, it's the same thing. And it's from confusion. It's from pure confusion.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, thanks to dispensationalism, people have lost any ability to what it truly means to rightly divide, and, you know, and bless their hearts. There's a lot of honest dispensationalists out there who love the Lord and consider themselves dispensational. And they are honestly attempting to just, you know, show the differences between the Old Testament, New Testament. There's an honest effort there by many of them, but what they all have in common where they're all wrong is they're all trying to prove a pre-trib rapture. And that's just an error. It's a big error. But also, too, they associate modern-day Judaism with the Israel of the Old Testament. And it's because they not only do they not understand what Israel is, they don't even understand what Israel was. They don't understand the covenants. You know, unfortunately, where you can hear a lot of truth about the covenants and how they work is from Calvinists. And you're not Calvinist, are you?
No, I'm not an anti-Calvinist, but okay. I'm not a Calvinist.
All right. I like to pick on Calvinists, so I didn't want to be too mean on your program or anything, but
yeah, no problem.
But no, but you know, they get some stuff right, and you know, so the thing is, they get a lot of things right when it comes to that, and I'm telling you that understanding how the covenants work is really important, and the dispensationalists, they just don't get it. And what I'm seeing happening is more and more people are learning the truth about these things. I think a lot of Baptists are digging in even deeper and going farther into this dispensational nonsense. And it's getting really bad. And
I think
the
you're
fact
right.
that we are seeing the things that we are seeing today and that Christians are supportive of it just shows that, you know, this is no small thing. I mean, the fact that Christians support the rebuilding of a temple, it shows they do not understand why the temple was there in the first place, and it shows too, they don't understand what it means to rebuild the temple. Nobody in the dispensational world wants to talk about 70 AD and what happened during that time. But understand that was fulfillment of major prophecies, including the Olivet Discourse, where they are getting the negative end of things. Mm-hmm. In many prophecies, you see a possibility of good, a possibility of bad, depending on what they do. Everybody thinks prophecy is just looking at a crystal ball and saying, this is what's going to happen. No, these things are an admonition to repent or to change something. And that's what that is. Well, they weren't ready. They got the negative outcome of things. God destroyed their temple. That nation ended. It ceased to exist. And that's a good thing for Jews because of the fact that temple was a stumbling block to them. It was keeping them from Christ. They were so married to those traditions. And to think that Christians, in the name of loving and supporting Jews, is excited about the rebuilding of the temple. It's and even according to dispensational theology, when the Antichrist rebuilds the temple, he's going to turn on and he's going to slaughter the Jews. And see, right. You're going to support the setup of a greater massacre than the Holocaust. What is wrong with you people? No, yep. The temple itself will be an abomination. Yep. And it will not be the temple of God. It'll be called the temple of God.
Right.
But it will not. It is one of the most blasphemous things. It is a rejection of the body and the blood of Christ. It's rebuilding what God had torn down, what God destroyed. Daniel 9, it's God bringing that judgment. And it blows my mind that Baptists especially are supportive of that. They need to wake up.
Yeah, and conveniently, it allows this power shift and power grab for the UN nation state to grab more, take more, kill more people, kill their neighbor, you know, whatever happened to love thy neighbor and all this stuff. And I'm not some pacifist hippie, like I will defend myself and my family, but I'm not going to send my kids to die in the sand so Bibi Netanyahu and the rest of the Kabbalists get anything. I mean, this is what's really weird is you have these Christian, it's very Americana construct, a lot, almost exclusively, which is what makes this focus on Israel even weirder, is because all the focus and attention is there. All their prophetic stuff exclusively applies to kind of America, because Christians globally have been suffering tribulation and persecution for a very long period of time. And we have been in this like kind of Christian bubble and not experiencing any of that, but yet they still come up with this like Willy Wonka golden ticket, like don't sweat it, you know, everything's going to be great. We're going to get yanked out of here right before anything bad happens. And it's completely wrong and false, but then it feeds this geopolitical war beast machine. Right. And well, we got all the support and we got to support Israel and we got to fund Israel. And then we're sending them tens and hundreds of billions of dollars to kill people that are actually brown, which is kind of hilarious, too, because Jesus was brown. And, you know, what if, and, you know, I've speculated this, when you start studying the genealogies, and there are Israeli professors that have done genetic work, right? And they claim, these Israeli professors claim, that the Palestinians genetically are more Jewish than the citizens of Israel. So if this climax is going to happen there, right, I believe that the millennial kingdom is New Jerusalem. I think that everything, and I think you believe the same thing. Like when Christ comes back and establishes the millennial kingdom, it's New Jerusalem. And the New Testament tells us that, well, in Hebrews, right? Like that there's Agar, and this is an allegory, but you know, Abraham looked for a city. Like the New Testament explains this, like, hey, Abraham didn't find what he was looking for. He was looking for New Jerusalem. And just like you were saying, the fulfillment of those Old Testament prophecies, they will be fulfilled by Christ, the seed, and new Jerusalem, which is above, and it's going to come down, and it's going to fulfill. All of the stuff is going to be fulfilled with Christ and new Jerusalem.
Right. Well, I've got a book right here. It's the works of King James. It's all writings that he did. And he wrote a paraphrase in here of Revelation chapter 11. And it's interesting because I won't read it. It's difficult to read just with that Gothic font. But he was of the persuasion in Revelation 11, when you have him trodden down the city for 42 months, he didn't make that about literal Jerusalem. He basically made that the false Catholic church, as he put it, going after the true Christian church, that he saw it as, just persecution of the people of God. And it just showed too, back then, before dispensationalism, they understood who they were, and as Christians. And, you talked about the genealogies and stuff. Something I keep throwing out to people, now I'm not getting any answers from the dispensationalists. And that is, when you look at the Israel of today, how do you biblically connect them to the Israel of the Bible? Mm-hmm. Because that's a very interesting study if you do that, because you know what? This is all they have. And it's not the connection, it's genetics. Okay, that's all they have. Now, I'll give it to them. Fine. They're purebred Jews. Fine. I'll give it to them. I've heard the
conspiracy. White.
To me, it doesn't even matter. Yeah. But here's the thing about that. Okay. It was never about genetics. Abraham, it's Abraham's seed, it's his descendants. Why not Ishmael? Why not the sons of Keturah? Sounds like it's not about genetics. How about Isaac? He had Jacob and Esau. Why not Esau? Mm-hmm. How about the fact too that when God gave the covenant of circumcision to Abraham and all of his house was circumcised, meaning his servants, meaning all the other people, even within the original groups amongst Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, there were many people that did not descend from them. They were people who were under their leadership. So in the Bible, when we're looking at the genealogies, it's mainly focusing on what I would call more of like a royal line of like the, of the direct descendants. And the Bible's doing that to show how certain prophecies were going to be fulfilled that were genetic, that obviously lead to Jesus Christ. But at the same time, Israel was never about a biological people. It was about a people within a covenant.
And that's why in Christ's lineage, you have Gentiles in Christ's lineage, right? That Rahab, right? Yep. So we have these, and I think that's why God put them in there. Say, hey, this isn't a bloodline.
Right.
This is, and then that, if you read that in light of the New Testament and who is a Jew, one inwardly, not one outwardly, one inwardly, it flows perfectly and it makes all of that come together. And you're like, oh, that's what it was. That's how this works. Yeah. And it all makes sense, as long as you are interpreting the Old Testament in the light and the revelation of the New Testament, which is what's fascinating, is the last book of the canon is called The Revelation of Jesus Christ, right? And then he that readeth, let him understand. And if so, we are looking for Christ in all these things, right? And all these fulfillments of the old. This is the grand crescendo. This is the end game of the Old Testament and the New Testament, and it's all coming together perfectly, and we're watching all of these prophecies being fulfilled and the wrapping up of the Old Testament and the manifestation, and it all points to Christ, and that's where we always get it wrong. It's not the revelation of the apocalypse, the revelation of doom and gloom, the revelation of destruction. It's the revelation of Jesus Christ. And if we're looking for Christ, we'll find him. We're not supposed to be looking for Antichrist, right? Everybody wants to try to predict all this Antichrist stuff. And, it's the revelation of Jesus Christ.
Right. Yeah. And just a great thing that I want everybody out there to do, especially if you go to a pre-trib church, every prophecy conference you go to, if they're pre-trib, 100% of them, they will talk more about current events in Israel than they will about Bible, for one. They will, if they, anybody, any preacher who does a series through Revelation, the revelation of Jesus Christ, will talk more about Antichrist. He will say the word Antichrist more than he says Jesus Christ. And the word Antichrist isn't even in the book of Revelation.
Right.
And Revelation is all about Jesus, and yet he's not talked about. And it's astounding because, again, when Revelation was written, at that point, and I hold to a late date of Revelation. I believe it was written after 70 AD. I don't hate people who disagree with me on that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, at that point, that old covenant had waxed old and had vanished away. It hadn't yet in Hebrews. It was getting close, though. It was about to. When Revelation is written, it has. It's been done. In the book of Acts, they basically, the book of Acts, if we wanted to sum up the entire book of Acts, it's an attempt of the apostles to bring the nation of Israel to repentance that ultimately failed. It didn't work. In the very last chapter, the very end of the last chapter, they come to the conclusion, well spake Isaiah the prophet. This is what Isaiah prophesied. They weren't going to listen. And so it was only a few years later where you have the Jewish-Roman war and Israel is destroyed, defeated. They were not delivered. The disciples knew what was coming. They wanted to see them saved and spared. And so I believe that point, that was a very definitive moment when that took place. The old covenant's gone. And so the thing is, when Revelation is now given to these seven churches, when that book of that revelation of Jesus Christ, this is showing how all things are fulfilled. They're all fulfilled through Jesus Christ. Revelation is all about Jesus. And the crazy thing is, you got Baptists talking about how the church can't find the church after Revelation chapter 4. They still make it all about the Jews.
Yeah.
They still make it all about the Jews.
And they gloss over 70 AD. I mean, and this is how come we have all this goofy Hebrew root stuff, right? Everybody, they all want to gloss over. Like, nobody can think, if your entire religious system revolved around the temple, I mean, that's where the sacrifices were, that's where the offerings were, that's where you met together, and then you had to do these things. I mean, if you were a believer, you had to do these things, and that veil gets ripped from top to bottom, and then the whole entire temple gets turned to rubble. I mean, that is the absolute definition of a crumbling, a complete destruction. That system and everything it was predicated upon was completely annihilated. That's why you got rabbis like slitting chickens and swinging them around their head, you know, in some crazy witchcraft move. Like, now what biblical principles can we learn from the Jewish rabbis with the killing of the chicken? And you know, that's what, it's crazy what some people, the extent that Christians go to extract wisdom from pagan rich, from Babylonian Kabbalism. It's unreal to me. It's like,
yeah. Well, let me read this passage to you. And I challenge anyone to find a dispensationalist preaching from this passage. And if you do know one, I would love to hear what he has to say about this passage. But Hebrews 12:25, talking to Jews, see that ye refuse not him that speaketh, for if they escape not who refused him that spake on earth, much more shall not we escape if we turn away from him that speaketh from heaven, whose voice then shook the earth. And that's a reference to Mount Sinai, when his voice shook the earth and it shook the mountain, melted that mountain. But now he hath promised, saying, yet once more, I shake not the earth only, but also heaven. And this word, yet once more, signifieth the removing of those things that are shaken, as of things that are made, that those things which cannot be shaken may remain. And what are these things? These are the things of the temple. These are the things of the old covenant that were given on Mount Sinai, and that Paul referred to, that were in Jerusalem, and that had the people in bondage during that time. And so when Jesus shook those things, okay, he did it like the walls of Jericho. I mean, they collapsed. They were gone. There wasn't any of it left. And it's the same thing, too. When he got rid of that temple, he made sure there wasn't one stone left upon another. He's sending a message loud and clear. I'm done with this place.
Yeah.
He is finished. And he brought in something that cannot be shaken. And that is the, and so, you know, when we read Hebrews, we're seeing that we're still not 100% there yet. What's going on? Well, God had this pattern that we see he had with the Jews for a long time of giving them 40 years. That's what he did in the wilderness when they came out of Egypt. And in the beginning of Hebrews, they are warned not to make the same mistake that their fathers made, who died in the wilderness. And God did. God gave that final generation 40 years to get on board with the new covenant. They never did. They got destroyed. The nation of Israel, the physical nation of Israel, because dispensationalists are right. There are differences between the Israel of the Old Testament and the church, as they would say, of the New Testament. There are differences because Hebrews shows there was a time of, there were certain things imposed on them until the time of Reformation. Yeah. So yeah, there's a lot of things that are different now, but that's because God reformed the true Israel. But that, yes, there was a physical nation. It had a land, all that thing one time, but that's gone.
And that's why the New Testament tells us that the law is our schoolmaster to bring us to Christ, because Christ completely fulfilled all that. You're not going to keep that and make God happy by keeping that, you know, all this Hebrew roots nonsense. It's really tongue and hand in glove with a lot of this stuff, where people want to drag the Old Testament forward and create this talking points and dialogue that Jesus was a Jew. And so, you know, he clearly taught the Old Testament. So that's why we have to keep the Old Testament. And that just ignores 98% of the New Testament. And it also ignores the fact that there is no temple. There's no Holy of Holies. There's no altar. There's no priest class to bring anything on your behalf to God. And they'll say, oh, well, yeah, Christ fulfilled that. He just didn't fulfill all the 618 other things that we have to do. You know, it's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there is an honest conversation that we can have. All of us agree that all prophecy is going to be fulfilled. The question is, how is it going to be fulfilled? You know, we're talking about, when we talk about the abomination of desolation, you know, we can talk about how we think that will play out. I think it will more than likely be played out through the Mark of the Beast system. But again, there could be something with the temple. I think we can be open to different possibilities. But again, you know, back to the possible rebuilding of the temple too, I don't think people realize how small of a minority there are of Jews who even want the temple to get, are trying to get the temple rebuilt. There's a few goofball online activist types out there who talk about the rebuilding of the temple and are wanting to see the Dome of the Rock. Brother Paul, he might have interviewed one of these guys. I know he was trying to. He wasn't able to when I was with him. I don't know if he ever did it or not, but they actively want to see the temple rebuilt. But they're like a fringe couple that just has a social media presence. When I talk to them at the Temple Mount Institute, you know, I'm asking them, like, you know, who would even be in charge? There's no plans. They're
exactly. And if this was going to be this, I mean, from an American perspective and from a preacher perspective, like, this is the culminating event. Like, exactly. Like, this has to happen because the Antichrist is going to sit here, and that's how we'll know. And look, everybody, there's a Temple Institute and they're getting ready to do this. And then, you know, every 5 years they trot back out the red heifer. Oh, look, they have the red heifer, you know. And then a buddy of mine said, he was talking to somebody over there. He's like, well, these cows are in a pen. They're completely unguarded. So even if you buy into this whole Hamas and all this stuff. Like, they could easily blow up these red heifers and destroy their entire propaganda machine, you know, and why doesn't that happen? Like, and then I don't know if you heard, they tied October 7th, you know, they leaked out that Hamas said one of the reasons they attacked on October 7th was because Israel has these red heifers ready, you know, and then they build this gigantic altar to blasphemously sacrifice these things. And like, oh, look, this is great. Like, you got Christians like, this is so good. Oh, the end is almost nigh, you know, and you, hey, we want Jews to be saved. Well, they're trying to blow themselves off the map, just so you know, understand how the geopolitics of all this works. But yeah, it's wild.
Well, one thing that really blew my mind when I was over in Israel, one thing I wasn't familiar with was in the old city, you have your Muslim quarters, your Jewish quarters, your Christian quarters, and your Armenian quarters, right? And I was trying to figure out who is actually in charge of the Temple Mount. And it's a very complicated thing. And it took me a lot of research before I finally was able to wrap my mind around it. But basically, Israel does technically control the Temple Mount. However, to keep the peace in the world, they have the Waqf of the Jordanians. They kind of are custodians of that area. But the Israeli government reserves the right, if they're not following certain rules, to enter the Temple Mount and to do whatever they think they need to do. So the thing is, what back in April, before last April, before October 7th, the Muslims didn't follow the rules, it should have been the Islamic police that went up there and took care of it, but the Israelis decided they were going to do it. And they went into the Al-Aqsa Mosque, which is an abomination to the Muslims, and beat the tar out of a bunch of them. And the October 7th attack was a response to what they did then. And so What happens in the Israeli government? They do things like that to provoke the Palestinians. And One of the things that I am expecting them to do at some point is, if it is, because part of the rules in the Temple Mount that the Muslims have too, because the Muslims, they don't want to admit the Israelis have control of it, you know, but it's one of those things, you know, they're kind of having this standoff. But you're not allowed to pray on there if you're not Muslim. You're not allowed to wear religious symbols. You know, they've got a dress code, and they have Muslims up there policing all that. But one of these days, what's going to happen, some rabbi is going to go out there, and he's going to sprinkle the ashes of a red heifer out there. And when he does, all hell's going to break loose in that area. And Christians will side. And think about it. The Christians will side with Jews doing these old covenant temple practices that are a rejection of what Jesus Christ has already done. They will support them on that. And when the Muslims react violently, and they will, then Christians will be like calling for their heads. Israel has a right to defend themselves. And, you know, it's literally the Israelis provoking. And so that's why they keep doing stuff. But again, if you think for 2 seconds that these people have any ability right now or any plans to rebuild the temple, I've got a video on my channel from several years ago that I did when they did an altar rededication. Or an altar dedication, I should say, in Jerusalem. And you want to talk about a joke watching this cheap performance. They had a menorah out there. They had an altar of incense. It wasn't even the ones from the Temple Mount Institute. They were even cheaper and faker than the ones in the temple at the Temple Mount Institute. It was a joke, but all it was bringing awareness to Jewish things. There are elements of Jews out there that try to fulfill prophetic things. And so anytime there's a Jewish holiday or an anniversary or something significant, they try to do some kind of thing with the hopes that it's a fulfillment of prophecy and it'll bring in the Messiah. But folks, nobody's going to usher in the Messiah by just doing wicked things like that. You had Greg Locke, who after October 7th was saying that they needed to clear off that, you know, that Temple Mount area and blow up that Dome of the Rock so they can rebuild the third temple and usher in the coming of Christ. No, we're not going to dictate Christ any of that stuff.
Yeah.
we're not going to help that stuff. And it's like, you people better watch it or the Lord might just let that happen, because it would cause World War III if that happened, and we're all going to suffer greatly. And it might not even mean that the end is nigh as a result of that. So I don't understand this promotion of this type of thing. It's not Christian at all.
And you made a really great point that that could happen, and that wouldn't even be a fulfillment of prophecy. It would be a geopolitical apparatus to propagandize some type of geopolitical move to either grab more land or get more funding or whatever. And that's what's so critical when looking at this topic. I mean, once you realize that a sacrifice after the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ is an absolute abomination to God, that in of itself basically foundationally crystallizes everything with a pre-trib notion and a temple and a sacrifice. And, you know, this sacrifice is supposedly going to be cut off. That can't be a reference to a physical sacrifice, because that is an abomination to God. And by no means should we think that that would ever be good, or should we encourage it, or, you know, like supposedly the rancher that developed this red heifer supposedly is a professing Christian. Like, what kind of professing Christian in their right mind? Oh, let me help the Jews, whoever they are, the white people in the Middle East. Let me help them get a spotless red heifer. So, I mean, because when you blaspheme God, you want your blasphemous sacrifice to be absolutely perfect. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, wow. I mean, we want to perfectly blaspheme God. It's just like, and that's how convoluted the concept is because, yeah, it's all thanks to dispensationalism and chop, 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 and put everything in a different box. And, you know, and that's not even getting into the Ruckmanism of like seven gospels and the gospel of Paul and all this stuff, you know. But you can see how you could really, once you get confused, you can really get confused, you know. Confusion just begets more confusion.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And it, you know, I remember it was in 2000, so 24 years ago, first time I went to Israel as a 19-year-old boy that believes everything he hears, you know, from other Baptists. I do remember when we went to the Wailing Wall. I do remember when we went out there, being shocked when I watched all people from our group. I just think I remember watching Baptist preachers go and lay their hands on the wall and start praying.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And I was like, now, you know, they were just praying for the peace of Jerusalem. You know, it's not a sin to pray for the peace of a Jerusalem or Chicago or Timbuktu. But, you know, we don't need to go to a wall to do something like that. And, you know, even that was off-putting to me. But then this last time, you know, I go there with my blinders off too. And I'm watching all these evangelical Christians, especially too. There's a lot of like your biker type, Americana type Christians. They're like the biggest ones. I saw some of them out there wearing these I Stand With Israel shirts. They got the Israeli flags on their clothes and stuff. And they're out there praying all over the wall. And there's a short documentary that I just watched. It's called Praying for Armageddon. And obviously this person's got the wrong mentality on a lot of stuff. But what's sad about this person who is not a Christian, it was very interesting to see from their perspective how Christians look who are literally praying for Armageddon, who are promoting a political agenda that will, what they call, bring, what they believe will bring in Armageddon. And a lot of them are like these biker type Christians and stuff. And it's true. But you know why they do that? Because they don't believe we'll be here for it. They believe we're going to get raptured out.
Exactly. So it's so nice. They think it's cool. Like, oh, it'll be cool that these people blaspheme God with their sacrifice because I got the golden Willy Wonka ticket. I'm not even going to be here. So like, that'll be cool when the nukes fall on them, you know. And you make another really great point about praying at the Wailing Wall and every U.S. president knowing it, you know, and even America's Messiah, Donald Trump, you know, that there was an inordinate amount in 2017. There was a ton of reporting that got that guy converted to not only converted to Judaism, but it was at that that one rabbi that says he's the Messiah. And I mean, talk about blasphemous. I mean, for one thing, there's this Jewish rabbi, whatever that means, and he's claiming to be the Messiah. And then Trump converts to Judaism, whatever that means, at this, I forget that name, but how much he's playing the Christians, you know, as this political Messiah, and how all of that works with, you know, he gets the crown of David, he gets this big silver Jewish crown thing, and it's all of this geopolitical wrangling that is based nowhere in scripture. It's based nowhere in reality. It is exclusively propaganda. And it's all based on a construct and a pretext that is exclusively unbiblical, which is kind of fascinating to me, because now you'll have these reformed guys, right? And I'm not voting for a pastor, I'm voting for a president, and God used Cyrus. And that's kind of like the way I see President Trump, you know, he's Cyrus, and, you know, we'll stop abortion and we're bringing the kingdom and all the, you know, all this like weird amillennial stuff. And they'll still, from a political standpoint, they'll explain away what clear facts and observation are to create a political environment so that you can vote for the lesser of two evils, and we can figure out a Christian way to politically wrangle this so that it works. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like the same idea. It's just strictly on a voting level.
Right. Yeah. And the thing that I find fascinating about Trump is I don't think he really cares that much about Israel. He's not like Ted Cruz. Ted Cruz, I mean, he would sell out our country for Israel so fast. And he does. He truly adores the nation, and it's his theology that pushes him to that. Trump talks a good game because he needs the evangelical vote.
Yeah,
and that I can't tell you how much that bothers me, that Trump is literally, you know, going along with something he doesn't even really believe in. Because I think he's got pretty good foreign policy for the most, in a lot of ways, for the most part, you know, he's not like the Bushes and people like that. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, because he's pandering to Christians, mm-hmm. and into talking a big game on something that will be bad foreign policy. And, you know, I don't know what'll happen with what's going on in Israel now if he becomes president, but I'm so sick of giving them money. I'm sick of Christians supporting that and being excited about it. And it's like, I believe prophetically things are going a certain direction. I would probably even agree with the dispensationalists with the direction things are going. I just wish we would stop promoting it, because one thing that also changed with the advent of dispensationalism is Christians used to have a mentality of thinking far into the future. We don't do that anymore. We're not trying to build a better world anymore. We're just trying to survive till the rapture at this point. And, you know, we don't want to have this Hezekiah mentality where, you know, hey, it's as long as there's peace and good in my days, you know, I'm happy. No, we need to be trying to build a better world. It could be hundreds of years before Jesus comes back. Let's not just let this nation go to hell. Let's not just, you know, watch the world burn and encourage it. You know, let's be Christians. Let's be peacemakers. you know,
like all the, you hear young couples. Yeah. You'll hear young couples like, oh, I couldn't have children. I'm not going to bring children into this mess. And like, I mean, be fruitful and multiply. I mean, that's one of the, you know, the chief aim of man is to honor and glorify God. We are created as God's image bearer to honor and glorify him. That's our chief aim. But as men and women and God's being married in God's covenant as a couple like God created is for the sole purpose of being fruitful, multiplying, having children, raising them up in the grace and the admonition of the Lord. I mean, if we're going to stop that because any second now, you know, these atrocious things are going to happen. Like we would literally, well, and we are, you know, the Christian population and density, and I'm not going covenantal on you, like, you know, like a family covenant or anything, but Christians are not being fruitful and multiplying, and the Muslims are, you know, and the and they're taking over, and the Catholics and the Muslims are still exponentially multiplying, and Christians, because of some terrible eschatology, have just like, yeah, shelter in place until Willy Wonka, you know, punches the golden ticket.
Right. Well, Christians aren't having a lot of kids for, you know, a couple of reasons. One, we're very intertwined with the American culture that's very materialistic.
Yeah.
But again, too, and also a lot has changed in our country, too, to where, you know, economically, financially, where we don't really own anything anymore. We don't have private property. And we're not able to build communities and things like that where we can do things as we see fit. And so as a result of that, yeah, the families are very broken up, not just you know, physically speaking, but, you know, we're not in the same businesses and we don't have inheritances we can leave. And but all of that goes back to a mentality where we're not thinking about future generations. And so, you know, I mean, I'm thankful that my dad, he was, got involved in ministry in the late 70s when everybody was pushing this pre-trib stuff. The rapture was about to come. It was going to come in 1988. You know, I'm certainly glad he still had kids, even though they thought this thing was about to wrap up. But at the same time, my dad, you know, the generation before me, that thought the rapture is going to come, they did. They let a lot of things slip. There's a lot of, especially doctrinally. And we are constantly reminded, specifically in 2 Timothy 2, where it says rightly dividing, that whole chapter is not about dispensationalism, but it's about preserving good doctrine. The things which I was learned among faithful men, the same commit thou to faithful men. I didn't quote that right. But it's all about preserving good doctrine. And they let it all fall apart during that time. And they thought we were almost out of here. You know, the Independent Fundamental Baptists, and I love the Independent Fundamental Baptists. I am one. But they kind of swung the pendulum. You had like your ivory tower Calvinists just want to study your Bibles all the time that kind of became worthless, weren't winning souls or anything like that. And they're like, we got to get on fire. We got to win souls. This thing's about to wrap up. But then they let doctrine fall apart. And you know, and so now my generation, we're trying to salvage something out of this mess. It's not really going well, you know, as a whole. But I'm all of those people out there doing it.
Yeah, and all those points that you mentioned. I mean, 10 years ago, we relocated because, you know, we were in the Northeast and we were looking around and we're like, how will we leave an inheritance to our children? And we moved with the forethought of we want our children to be able to buy land. We want them to be able to afford to live and to excel in all these things. And we moved 10 years ago. And then we changed our paradigm even to like, well, rather than accumulating stuff for the future, what if we actively accumulate dirt? And so we buy more land and then the kids can work with us and help us develop that. And literally the traditional old time American culture where you would have a homestead and you could have multiple homes and the parents raise the children, they all work together. You would only need one tractor. when dad needs to go in the nursing home, the kids are there, they're well established, they can take care of them, so we don't got to farm him out to the long-term care facility, you know. And if we could get back to some of these traditional principles that used to be commonplace in America in the 40s and 50s, it would resolve a lot of those issues with parents not having children and just having an incredibly doom and gloom, you know, kids are expensive. Like, we can't have kids. Kids are expensive. Like, that's just not true. Like, you have eight kids. I mean, we were crazy dirt poor with three kids, and you know, we could afford three more. And you know what's awesome? You step out on faith and you do that, and God blesses you and he rewards you 100-fold because you are doing what he told you to do, you know, and it's a blessing. Children are a blessing.
Well, yeah. And of course, we've been poor, you know, pretty much our whole married life. But at the same time, I mean, the Lord's blessed us. You know, the Lord has been very good to us. And, you know, even now, when in reality, in many ways, I should be at my poorest, you know, we're not, just because, you know, when you have a lot of kids and when you have all these different things, you actually learn how to manage things. And everybody has this mentality of, like you said, stuff, right? Well, the thing is, there's an unlimited amount of things you can just blow money on. There really is. And so people who have that just selfish mentality too, and don't want to have the kids or anything, they're not accumulating, they're spending, you know. And that's what our government wants. You know, they want the husband, and, you know, and you just have to do the math on these things. You know, I don't want to go all nerd and take time, you know, on this right now, but our government, I remember Bush, or George W. Bush, you know, encouraging people getting second jobs, talking about, you know, the wives working. That benefits the government so much. And it sounds like if you're thinking only income, of course it helps to have your wife work. But if you're thinking outgo as well, it's not. You're not going to be better off. And what it, you know, in most cases, it's mathematically not going to benefit you. The system is rigged against us. You got to figure out the system, and you know, and you can beat it. And what's interesting, it works best if you do things a biblical way.
Yeah, that's right. I was a financial planner for 11 years, and we would always do a financial analysis, and almost always it was dual income. And we would show the wife, like, well, once you take in the second car, the insurance, the daycare, the aftercare, and all these other things, your job is costing you money every month. And so if you would quit your job and be a keeper at home and do the things that the Lord created you to do, you would actually have more discretionary income.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And said in there, there's just so much value to, you know, the mom being at home, you know, raising your own kids, the homeschooling, the things that you've got to undo and fix, you know, if you have them in that system, there's no benefits. There really is. There's no benefit whatsoever.
Yeah. And even the notion that you think you might be able to fix half of that stuff is a stretch, you know, which is once again why we're losing the culture. It's not a culture war. You're not going to be able to win that culture. I mean, we really have to be anti-culture in a biblical sense. You know, if they hated me, they're going to hate you. So, you know, we want to pray for that we live in peace with all men. But the reality is if we're living a biblical life, if we're proclaiming the gospel, they didn't like it when Christ and the apostles proclaimed the gospel, and all of them, got martyred except for John. So that's interesting too, you know, and once again, that just crushes this pre-tribulation, like Christians aren't going to suffer tribulation, even though Christ and the very first church he established, they all were martyred. It's like, it's really interesting the gymnastics you have to go through to make these this type of systematic system work. But
And that's interesting too. You brought up in the beginning James Beller's book, America in Crimson Red, too, because he had a lot of good information on bloodshed in America, you know, by Baptists, you know, martyrdom by Baptists in America. And to watch those same people just to go around and, you know, one of his biggest disciples, you know, is a big pre-trib guy and acts like teaching that we're going to go through tribulation is teaching Jesus slapping his bride. And it's just like,
and he used the word Yahweh, and I'm like, oh, you're King James guy, huh? Where'd you get that word Yahweh from? That's interesting. That's postmodern.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, just the pandering that they do to the Jews, it really is. It's astounding. And I'm so thankful that there are many people calling it out. And, you know, and unfortunately a lot of people are letting the, you know, again, I'm from the IFB world. They're letting them run you out. Don't let them run you out. You know, stand strong, stand up for these things, because, you know, I don't know. I'm like the Apostle Paul was with the Jews. He just couldn't let go of those people, you know, and he, even though all the people were prophesying and telling him by the Holy Spirit not to go back to Jerusalem, he still went back to Jerusalem, you know, and he got beat up and went to prison and had all kinds of problems as a result of it. But I'm the same way with my IFB brethren. You know, I'm going to make them physically remove me, and because I do love those people, and I am one of them. They are my brethren. And Paul called, you know, I always tell people too, you know, don't make the mistake just because you read brethren in the Bible, it's talking about saved people. Jews, saved Jews, when talking to unsaved Jews, would still call them brethren, you know, and I believe IFB are saved, but you know, they're my brethren, but man, they're wrong on this, and they have got to get this right. And the previous generation that, you know, bought hook, line, and sinker all this pre-trib nonsense, they might not be here when it all goes down. It might be me, or I might be preparing the next generation for it. And when it all starts happening, I don't want everybody looking at me like, why didn't you warn me about this? How'd you get this wrong? And I'm going to keep running my mouth about it.
Well, I think it's great. Just before we wrap up, where can people find you?
Yeah, so our church is in Rock Falls, Illinois. We're about 2 hours west of Chicago, not super far from the Iowa border. And you can find us online, givemelibertybaptist.com, youtube.com/givemelibertybaptist. Look up Liberty Baptist Rock Falls. I also have a podcast. It's on YouTube and a bunch of other platforms called The Spirit of Prophecy. And I, on that channel, I mainly focus on prophetic stuff and talk a lot about Israel and things like that. So you can find me at either of those places.
Well, this has been great, man. I appreciate it. And maybe what we could do is when the documentary comes out, maybe we could get back together and discuss what the current talking points are and see what has changed and whatnot, and talk a little bit about the documentary, Pastor Tommy. But I really appreciate your time. I appreciate you coming on. I hope this was edifying. I hope this was a blessing. Look, if you are of this pre-trib persuasion, I hope you would consider that position. You would consider what we're talking about. And I really hope, as a professing Christian or as a real Christian, that you would consider it when you consider your political standing and who you're going to support and who you think should and shouldn't be funded. And, you know, as Christians, we should not be supporting like mass genocide. And that's why this topic is very important too. And Palestinians need Jesus just as much as the Jews need Jesus. And neither of these people get second chances. And all that being said, the citizens of Israel are just as much a pawn and collateral damage as the Palestinians. And that's what I think speaks greater to this entire topic. This is a geopolitical machination that's exclusively being used as a beast system infrastructure to precipitate beast. And I always say the beast is going to beast, you know, Brother Beller, that's what he said. He's like, every government's a beast. The beast has to be chained, which is all the more reason why, oh yeah, let's build a third temple and let's invoke like nuclear war. No, that's not living at peace with all men. That is political suicide. It could be physical, literal suicide. And that's why I want all y'all to consider this. That's why I think it's important. I think it's great to discuss it, talk about it, share it. Hey, y'all, we're on all your podcatchers. If you like it, give us a 5-star review. Share it with your friends and family. It'll create a good discussion. And it's always a great discussion if you can intentionally and purposely discuss the scripture and consider your own soul, consider your state, and examine yourself and see whether you be in the faith. I think it's awesome. Brother Tommy, thanks again. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for taking the time. And hopefully we can get back together again in the future. And remember, y'all, stay fearless, my friends.